Howdy, pardners, and welcome to episode 161 of the Diddly Dum podcast, the darn tootingest Doctor Who podcast out there. I'm Doc Holliday.
I'm Wyatt Gribble.
And I'm dressed up like Tom Mix. I should have said I'm Mark Regret.
No regrets. No, we have no regrets. Yes, welcome, listeners, to not only our 161st podcast, but finally, fanfare, please, computer. Mark's 100th Diddly Dum podcast.
Hooray! Unbelievable.
Is that 100 in a row, or is that 99 in a row with one slightly detached?
It's the latter. For those of you old enough to remember, I don't need to tell you, but Mark guested on Diddly Dum podcast number 60, Murray's Mint, in July 2016. A Whosium episode, as I seem to remember, where he presented us with his Dennis Fisher giant robot, his Marvel Uncanny X-Men comic number 218, and his papier-mâché Dalek made by Emily from Bagpuss for a permanent exhibition in the Whosium. Little did Mark know that he was being secretly auditioned by Hayden and myself for a permanent host spot. And he joined us permanently as a fixture from Podcast 63, our Missing Episodes podcast, in September 2016, which means he's now done his 99th podcast in a row, which even I haven't done. Hang on, does that mean that the next podcast, he gets another 100th celebration?
When you say, my dear Doc, that Mark is a fixture in the Whosium, it must feel a bit like Han Solo in Carbonite in Jabba's palace.
Well, we've tried everything to try and shift it, haven't we?
We have. Listen, people, I'm afraid I'm going to have to just barge in with this episode. I have prepared a little something for Mark. Computer, cue the music. Yes, you've guessed it, dear listeners. It's a far distant cousin of our usual game, Who Said What? This time it's a very special edition. It's called Mark Said What?
What?
Oh.
Yes, now I've sprung this upon you two here, so I do apologise, but in front of me I have 10 questions of Mark's time during his run on the Diddly Dump podcast. So, fingers on buzzers, lads. There is a bonus round question, just in case we go to a tie here. But and Mark, I fully expect you to win this. Okay, so, question number one. Which episode of Extreme Jamminess prompted Mark to write into Diddly Dumb and inadvertently resulted in him becoming a co-presenter? Brucey.
I can't remember what number the podcast was.
You don't have to tell me the number of the podcast.
Oh, I was listening.
It's literally, yeah.
I believe we featured a part of it recently because I think it was the Chris Achilleos interview after he gave you a signed print of the Abominable Snowman cover that he did for the Target books.
That's first point to Mark. I've got written down here, Hayden going to interview Chris Achilleos at his house and getting signed art.
Podcast 49.
This makes me so angry.
Question number two. What episode number did Mark make his debut as a presenter?
I know this because Doc just said it was number 63.
Well
missing
done.
Missing episodes.
Yes, it was. Okay, question number three. What is Mark's favourite era of Doctor Who?
I'm not even sure myself.
All right, we have to pass that one over to Doc.
It's the period that falls in between Nightmare of Eden and Sharda.
I've actually got written down here the Graham Williams era.
It is one of my favourites, so that's fair enough. Yes.
All right, but I'm afraid I'm going to have to give that one to Doc, because Doc was technically correct. So that's 2-1 to Mark. Okay, question number four. Mark is synonymous with his impression of Sir Bruce Forsyth. But can you name another he has brought to the Whoseum? Okay, that's Mark.
Was it when I accidentally went into Bernard Manning voices whilst reading out Dave Kitchen's letters?
I've got it written down. Bernard Manning's / David Kitchen.
That's no comment on David Kitchen whatsoever, just a random voice that I started doing to read out his letters. It simply amused me, nothing more. And apparently it sounded like Bernard Manning, so it was inadvertent.
Question number five. What was the name of the Planet of the Apes character whose action figure met an unfortunate end at the hands of Mark? Oh, Mark.
It was Galen. It's a f***ing disgrace.
Oh, 4-1 to Mark. Come on, Doc. Okay, question number six. Which Doctor Who story prompted Mark to pee in a toy boat?
It was... Oh, no, don't tell me. It was... no! Oh, Sigon. Terror of the Sigons.
That is correct.
Was it? Yes.
Oh, 4-2. 4-2.
A plastic boat, by the way. I wasn't like on an actual boat.
Right, question number seven. Which cast member of Blake 7 did Mark sabotage their performance-wise when he was a stagehand?
Oh, no.
As Doc?
No, I can't remember her name.
Oh, that goes over to Mark.
Hang on, which cast member?
Yeah.
Callie.
Yes, that's what I've got written down. I didn't know the actress's name, but I put Callie.
It's Jan Chappell.
Jan Chappell, that was it.
There we are. Ooh, there's 4-3. Oh my God. Could we really have a game where Mark loses a game all about him? I'm not sure.
Was that the anecdote where Mark informed us that stage handling is like making love to a beautiful woman?
He's the Swiss Tony of the stagehand world.
Yeah.
So what was the score again?
It's 4-3 to Mark.
Oh, I'm creeping up. Ooh.
Question number eight. Which famous musician was Mark mistaken for once by the guitarist in Sweet?
Oh. Oh, Doc's never going to remember this. He gets confused. It's himself. It was Bob Geldof.
It was indeed Sir Bob Gandalf. It's 5-3 to Mark. Question number 9. Which Doctor Who showrunner continually breaks into Mark's house and carries out unpleasantness upon his person? Ooh, that was Doc.
Chris Chibnall?
Yes, it was. It's 5-4. Right, question number 10. Finally, how many episodes has Mark missed since he starred as a guest on Diddly Dum back in 2016? That's Doc.
2.
Yes.
Although, technically, he wasn't invited on them, so he didn't really miss them. But,
The range that I had was 0 to 2. Because I thought, well, if we're going to split hairs, we'll say 2. If we're not going to split hairs, we're going to say none. So there we go, it's 5-5. So, it all rests on the bonus question. Who does Mark love most, Doc or Hayden? Okay, Mark.
I'd perv you an absolute shower.
Doc.
Hayden?
Correct. Well done. Well done, Doc. You won Mark's This Is Your Life. Congratulations. Oh, dear. Let this be a lesson to any aspiring podcasters out there that podcasting damages memory cells.
Yeah, sorry, I had some of Earp's heavy blow and I went kind of mental under it.
Well, thank you very much. That was Mark Said What?
Well, congratulations on your landmark achievement, Mark. It's been an experience, hasn't it, Hayden?
I mean, to be honest, I was thinking about this the other day, and I was thinking, in the time that I have known Mark, I have got older.
Have you?
I mean, about 6 years older. When I met you, I was but a spring chick hopping around the halls of the Whoseum. And now it's just incredible to think that 100 episodes has gone. I nearly said 100 years then. 100 episodes has gone by.
It's interesting, isn't it? If you'd never done that Chris Achilleos interview, Hayden, because you lost your dad around about that time, didn't you?
Yes, yeah.
Then Mark's sort of rumbling discontent at your jamminess may have stayed hidden. And he might never have got in touch with us, and we might never have been aware of his existence. And a fair few things have changed in my life caused by encountering Mark. Yes, it probably would have been better if you hadn't done that Chris Achilleos interview, eh?
I really apologise. I'm so sorry.
Now, Mark, it's your opportunity now to say something nice to us. Oh, it's been the best time of my life.
Just edit something I've said that was nice from one of the older episodes in, can you?
There's a line in Red Dwarf when Rimmer's saying goodbye to the crew.
Look, I'm not much good at big speeches. And I know I haven't always been an easy guy to get on with. And I know that given the choice, I probably wouldn't have chosen you as friends. But I just want to say that over the years, I have come to regard you as people I met.
You could put that line in. But think of all the adventures we've had. I mean, we've been to Satellite 5 and played Christmas Games of Doom. We've been to the Capitol all together. We've been to the BFI. We've interviewed Annika Wills together.
We've watched a hologram of Liam Neeson punch out Jason Donovan together.
I wouldn't have missed that for the world.
No.
That was fantastic.
That was the best one.
Yeah, I mean, all those. We met, obviously, Miles Northcott and his lovely lady wife.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
Yes.
Went to that wine cellar on Embankment. You danced with my mum and the bridesmaids at my wedding.
What a night.
Yes. I saw that style of dancing I'd never seen before at Hayden's wedding, thanks to Mark.
It was erotically charged.
What, with my mum and my sisters? Hang on a minute.
Mark and I went to, well, Hayden didn't because he was moving, either busy moving house or busy tending to his pregnant wife.
No.
What were you doing in 2019?
What were we doing in 2019?
Moving house?
No. 2017 was when we moved out. 2019 was planning for the wedding.
Mark and I ended up in Oldbourne.
Yes.
I ended up covered in ketchup. Well, Hayden wasn't with us, so if Mark hadn't been with us, I wouldn't have gone on my own. So I would never open that ketchup bottle.
Oh, and of course, I mean, one of the great things for me probably was taking my daughter Polly to meet Annika Wills at the Capitol, which was a wonderful moment. I just basically went through a list of female companions' names when naming Polly. So it was nice for Polly to meet her namesake.
And also, we obviously went to the Fitzroy Tavern.
Oh, yes, I met Dave Kitchen.
Dave Kitchen.
Oh, I'm so sorry, Dave. And he gave such lovely feedback to the last podcast as well. When he gave me one of the highest compliments, and that was that on two occasions I nearly caused a pile-up on an Australian freeway. Which, so thanks for that, Dave. Oh, and he mentioned me in relation to the invasion of the dinosaurs on the recent Doctor Who show podcast. So
thank you
very much for that.
Yes,
as well.
He did.
Marvellous.
Yes. I think he also referred to, or was it himself or Rob, on a recent Doctor Who show, mentioned the Friends of the Nymon as well.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Another august organisation of which I'm proud to be a founding member.
Right. Well, following Hayden's jaw-dropping revelation in our last podcast, that he used to work on the neonatal intensive care unit and special baby unit at Adam Brooks Hospital, we've now ditched Doctor Who completely, so welcome to episode one of our new podcast reviewing Call the Midwife, and This Is Going to Hurt. Only kidding. But more jaw-droppers have come to light since we last assembled listeners. Since when Hayden has discovered that he has a family connection with Doctor Who, haven't you, Hayden?
Yeah.
Yes, I have actually, yeah. Now, I had a crazy Monday a couple of weeks back, listeners, where...
Just another crazy Monday!
I went over to my mum's and she gave me a family tree that my grandfather had.
She said, Hayden, we took this down on the 6th of January, we would not be able to get rid of it yet. We took it out, will you?
So the soil on the back seat of the car was just atrocious. There's not been that much dirt on the back seat of my car since my old Ford Fiesta, so...
I'm glad you said something as calm as that.
Oh, I wondered where that was going then.
I pulled away before it got any dirtier, so that's...
Oh.
Anyway.
Help.
Your mum gave you a family tree?
Yeah, my mum gave me this envelope, and within it was this big, vast sheet that is essentially the Gribble family tree. And I was looking across there, and a few really amazing things came up in this. One of them was the fact that the first Gribble on record is on a marriage certificate somewhere in Cornwall in 1653. Uh-huh. And it was a Mr. William Gribble was married on that day. So the oldest Gribble on record shares the same name with the youngest Gribble on record, and that's my son.
Oh, see.
Which is very strange. And also, so basically, don't want to bore you with the details, but my family originates...
Too late! Only kidding, of course.
Just for that, I'm going to take you through all 18 generations that we found now.
And then William Gribble begat Hector Gribble.
My family originate from Switzerland and Germany, and then settled in Cornwall as cotton pickers in the 1600s. And a branch of the family stayed down there.
Cotton picking Gribbles.
Picking Gribbles. That's going to be the podcast title now. Overshadowing Mark. There we are. So there was a branch of the family who actually stayed down there. And I was looking along the line and I discovered that my great-grandfather was one of 11 children. And his younger brother had a daughter who, on the sheet, and it doesn't quite marry up, so I don't know how accurate the dates are, because the birthday is a couple of years earlier than the actress herself. But there's a D. Rose Gribble. Now, I'd been asked by a podcaster for, well, enough time actually, Andy Priestner, about 10 years ago, when I knew him in completely different universe altogether, really, outside of podcasting. And he asked me straight away, he said, you're not related to Dorothy Rose Gribble, are you? And I said, no, I'm sure not. Turns out I am. Turns out she was my granddad's cousin. And it has actually led me to Toby Haydock's Who's Round, because she did an interview with him, or he did an interview with her, sorry, about a year before she passed away. She lived until she was 97. But yeah, she was my, what do you call her?
First cousin twice removed.
First cousin twice removed, yeah. Okay, so yeah, that's Dorothy Rose Gribble. And Dorothy Rose Gribble, to any of you who don't know, it clearly was in Doctor Who, because otherwise why would we be talking about it? She played a prisoner in The Romans, in episodes 2 and 3 of The Romans.
Did she put down as a slave?
That's it, yeah. Well, slave, prisoner. I just remember she's in the prison cell, isn't she, in that one? So
that's on episode 79 of Toby Haydock's Who's Round podcast, which if we listen to it, I wonder if she'll be saying, well, you know, my grandson the other day gave me a copy of our family tree, and you'll never guess who I'm related to.
Aidan Gribble from the Diddly Dumb podcast. But yeah, my granddad was one of only two of the sets of Gribbles that actually moved out from away from Cornwall and moved to London. So we became the London branch of Gribbles, and Dorothy's family are from Devon. So
I didn't know they grew cotton in Cornwall.
Well, not now. This was about 300, 400 years ago, but it was, yeah, they were cotton pickers.
Have you, anyone in your family ever done your family tree, Mark?
There's someone called Caroline John, but I don't think she's ever been in Doctor Who. Nothing much of any interest.
We did one and discovered that part of our family decamped en masse to Australia in the 1850s to teach Australians a new method of making bricks. And so there were another four children were born in Australia, including my great-great-grandmother. And then they all, for about 10 years, they all came back to Lancashire.
Yeah, so, of course, when it comes to the fifth generation back of Gribbles...
I think we can move on from this now, thanks, Hayden.
No, but while I was going to get the crux of the argument...
Hayden, can we move on from this now, please?
No, I've got the conch.
Give it back to me. Give me the conch.
I've got
the conch. I want to talk. Give it.
Oh. Yeah. No.
God. I hope you two are proud of yourselves. Can you pass me that dustpan and brush, please, Hayden?
I'm sorry, Mark. Okay, here we go.
Careful, Mark. Don't break it.
Oh, who do you think you are, Matt Stevens?
Sadder news. Since we last podcasted, we've lost a couple of Doctor Who people. Stuart Bevan, we lost at the end of February.
Oh, yeah. That was very sad, actually. Because that made for such a nice capital event, didn't it? That whole Green Death panel with Katie and Stuart Bevan. And he was a lovely chap and very engaging and great listening to his stories, and especially about that time he was in a film with John Wayne. I was very, very sad that he went. He was, that was the capital that Polly came along to as well. I haven't mentioned it to her yet that he's passed, and I'm sure she'd be quite upset about that, because meeting Stuart and Katie was one of them. Many highlights of a capital visit.
Born to Welsh parents. His full name is Stuart John Llewellyn Bevan. These Welsh gets everywhere, don't they? Played, of course, Professor Cliff Jones in The Green Death. Played Max in the Death Watch episode of Blake 7, which I don't think Hayden's reached yet, because he's got into a bleak era, hasn't he, at the moment?
It's all bleak, Doc. It's all
far
bleak.
More importantly, he played Flight Sergeant Sharp in the first episode of the third series of Secret Army. Ooh. And, of course, he was engaged to Katie for, a couple of years in the mid-70s, wasn't he?
Yeah. Well, they were an item, weren't they, whilst she was filming Green Death with him.
Yes, of course.
I was going to say, this is possibly one of the saddest deaths of not the regular cast members, but... one of the guest stars in the show. Because when you think, you know, the story of Cliff and Joe obviously echo through to the Sarah Jane Adventures, and he made one appearance, but actually it was a fairly significant appearance because it takes away the Doctor's companion, obviously, then pledged to be married at the end of the Green Death. You know, and it changes the Third Doctor.
Yeah, well, he was also a very much a kind of... Well, he was a Third Doctor alternative, wasn't he, as well? So, the character. And yeah, I agree. I think his character and the role, that part, did have emotional resonance, which not many characters get. So I would agree with you, Hayden.
No.
I think also they were still great friends, weren't they? They had magnificent chemistry when they were doing the panel at the Capitol. It was lovely to see them with each other, and just the way they talked and just that that atmosphere between them. It was genuinely friendly and loving, so it was lovely to see.
And about a couple of weeks later, we also lost Linda Barron.
Yeah. Now, you chaps are, I'm afraid, are a little too old for this, but she was known to many children throughout the 90s and noughties.
Come Outside.
As a... Auntie Mabel, yeah, from Come Outside with Pippin.
Well, yeah, well, that's indeed. No, I'm very familiar with that. I haven't been a parent at the time. So, yeah, we used to watch that all the time, Come Outside, where she flew off in a plane with her dog.
Yeah, it was excellent. Pippin the dog. Look up, look down, look all around, up in the air or on the ground.
When there's cleaning to be done, there's a way to make it fun. Sing a little song, it will help you along. Sweep, sweep, sweep the path. Wash the dishes to keep them clean. Scrub the floor, scrub it well,
till there's blood upon the sawdust in the Last Chance Saloon.
Gosh, can I detect a hint of a link to Gunfighters?
I think recently I saw her make an appear on Celebrity Pointless as well. I can't remember who she was teamed with.
Was it Pippin?
No, it wasn't Pippin, sadly. But yeah, she seemed like a lovely woman. And of course, probably best remembered for her Rack, Captain Rack, Enlightenment.
Oh, right, sorry, yes. I just...
Charming.
Which is just a fantastic performance, really.
Yeah, she's very good in that. And obviously as the shop assistant in Closing Time as well.
Val.
Yes.
Born in Urmston in Lancashire, which obviously I suppose now is Greater Manchester.
Oh, I didn't know she was from Manchester.
Possibly most famous for playing Nurse Gladys Emanuel in Open All Hours.
Yeah.
With Ronnie Barker and David Jason in the 80s.
Oh, she also made an appearance as a, I think, as a busty prostitute in The Hands of the Ripper, a early 1970s Hammer film, I believe.
Well, that's interesting. She played a brothel madam in Rome, which is becoming something. Saying, once you start playing prostitutes, that's all you can ever get jobs for now.
What you mean, Rome? What from what about 10 yes, years ago?
The big thing they filmed in there.
Really?
So she's the when they take Octavian to have sex for the first time to a brothel. She's the madam who's tells them to get lost.
Bye, be off with you. This isn't no infantry f*** all, thank you very much.
Oh.
It's not quite sweep the floor, is it?
Yeah, I must confess I never watched that series, but I remember my dad liking it. Now I know why.
It's very good, actually. It's a really good... It streams, but I tried watching it once on streaming, and they've cut a pile of stuff out, so I don't know if they've cut... Some of the more extreme scenes out. But I've got it on DVD.
Well, this is a problem with streaming services, isn't it? I noticed this keeps coming up quite a lot in fandom in general, discussions about TV series, because I think with Star Trek being all disappearing from lots of platforms and ending up on Paramount channel, and a lot of people are very unhappy about it. But this is what happens when you don't buy hard physical copies of stuff you love. You'll lose it, or they'll tamper with it, and they'll cut bits out, and bits will be cut out never to be seen again. So, you know, having physical copies of stuff is taking control of the situation. Also means that if the internet goes down, which you never know, may well do, you've still got access to lots of lovely entertainment.
Speaking of which, I know a lot of people are watching Doctor Who on BritBox now, because the classic series is up there. But I know that they're not remastered, so they're just...
Oh, that's interesting.
Sort of older copies. So again, another reason to buy the Blu-rays.
Oh. And of course, presumably, you've got no access to all the extras, have you?
No, you haven't.
Talking of Star Trek, I watched the first episode of the second series of Picard the other night, and, well... I wasn't impressed.
No.
No, I'm not watching it because I hated that first series. It was morbid as hell. And I don't want to be constantly reminded that people I liked watching when I was a kid are now really old.
I know, he's got such a doddery old man's voice, hasn't he, now?
Oh, it's, hello, I'm John Luke Picard and my voice
he's
is very...
He must be 82 now. Patrick Stewart, 81. Mm. It's a bit over the top, really. And so much of it is... I'm just thinking, God, will you get on to doing something? He's chatting to people in his bloody vineyard. And I will get something done. And you've also got this thing that seemed to come in with Discovery, which was that half the bridge crew on Starfleet ships now seem to have to be extremely wacky and kooky and annoying beyond belief. However, the final 30 seconds of episode one made it for me. So,
what, the credits?
No, the cliffhanger. And so I shan't say anything to anyone.
No.
Has anything else been happening?
Probably.
Right. And we thought we'd do a tribute to Linda Barron today. And her third appearance in Doctor Who was, of course, as the singer in the 1966 serial The Gunfighters. And so, in tribute to Linda... So come on, all you listeners, and join in our tune. It's an exercise in finding words that rhyme with saloon. Right, The Gunfighters, Season 3, the final season of William Hartnell's era. Four episodes broadcast in April and May 1966. This was actually the last serial of the classic series to have been given individual episode titles.
Yep, yeah.
Which I wasn't aware of. Written by Donald Cotton, who interestingly also did Mythmakers, which himself is a slightly comedy historical, isn't it?
Mm.
Not exactly comic, but you know what I mean. It's
it is quite funny.
Jokey, yeah.
It turns quite nasty at the end, doesn't it? If I seem to remember, but...
I think that's quite common in a lot of William Hartnell historicals, isn't it?
Or
relatively common, that there seems to be quite a lot of joking about and gadding around in some high adventure, and then something quite terrible happens. Mm. I mean, even in the Time Meddler, there's stuff happens to people that's really not... Very nice. And the Mythmakers, obviously, the massacre. although, not that that's a particularly amusing story by the sound of the audio. The Romans as well.
Yes, religious genocide. Oh, it was a laugh. A few of the historicals are quite comical. In the middle of, between commissioning this story and it being finished and broadcast, they had the problem of Donald Tosh, the story editor, and John Wiles, the producer, resigning in the January to be replaced by...
Yeah. Jerry Davis, yeah.
Innes Lloyd was it as the producer and Jerry Davis as the story editor. And from what I gather, Donald Cotton wasn't that keen on writing for Jerry Davis, and Innes Lloyd wasn't a huge fan of historicals, and nor was Jerry Davis that keen on comedy. So I imagine there were some difficulties there. Directed by Rex Tucker, who was one of those original producers that was hanging on to the show just before they appointed Verity.
Yeah.
Was he in An Adventure in Time and Space?
They had composite character, didn't they?
Oh, yes, of course they did, didn't they? Yeah.
Several of them.
I've just been... In fact, I just finished watching about an hour ago the movie of which this is apparently meant to be something of a parody.
Oh.
Which is the 1957 Western Gunfight at the OK Corral, which actually I really liked. It wasn't one of those ones where, you know, there's... You got about 10 minutes of someone riding across the plains on a horse to music. It was really enjoyable. But Lancaster as Wyatt Earp. Kirk Douglas was brilliant as Doc Holliday.
Mm.
And one of Wyatt Earp's brothers was played by a young DeForest Kelly.
No.
Yeah.
Bones McCoy himself. Jeez.
Yeah. I was sitting at this table in this wooden hut, and I was thinking, he's familiar. No, it can't be him. It doesn't look like anything like him, but I thought, oh, his voice looks it. So I was quickly IMDBing it, and it was him after all. It was strange. If you want to have a look at this and see all our other show notes, you can find them on our podcast blog at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com. I have read some people say that it's better to look upon this less as an attempt at a genuine historical and more as an attempt at a parody of the Western genre. I'm not sure, really. Any thoughts on it?
When I first saw this, it would have been when it came out on video at the start of the 2000s, I think. And, I mean, no, I wasn't that young. I was still obviously... somewhat of a humourless young man when it came to Doctor Who. And I think I liked my Doctor Who, well, I wouldn't say straight as such, but sometimes the Nine-One's always got a pass from me for its failings because I saw it on broadcast. So I loved it at that time. And it earned a place in my heart along with the rest of season 17. But there was no such attachment to William Hartnell. So I remember watching it and thinking, well, this is just absolutely appalling. And I thought, well, this is awful because this song is awful. These accents are awful. This is a stupid idea for a Doctor Who story. This is a boring historical. And I'm not even sure I watched it all the way through. And then I watched it this afternoon. And it's... was an absolute delight from start to finish.
Oh, you were keeping us on tenterhooks there, weren't you, Mark? What's he going to say? What's he going to say?
And I sat there with a big dopey grin over my face. That's my take on it. I really enjoyed it because I just thought it was funny. I know that if I'd seen this as a young kid, I would have loved it, I think, because of it was cowboys shooting each other. The morals and the fact that it was people who were dying is never something you worry about as a kid, is it? It's just action and adventure. And so I wouldn't have been worrying too much about the morals, just enjoying the shooting. Although it might have been a little bit too talky for me as a kid.
Released on VHS in 2002, is that when you first saw it?
Yes, yeah.
You must have either had a lot of money or a lot of storage space, Mark, because it was released in a three-story box set. Together with the Sensor Rights and the Time Meddler. What if you said to yourself, oh, I don't like this gunfighters, I'll try this Sensor Right, see if that's any more interesting.
that didn't go well either.
Released on DVD in 2011. It's had this reputation, hasn't it, for a long time as being one of the worst stories ever.
Well, like I said, and I would have agreed with that in the early 2000s, but I just really enjoyed it. And can't just say what I love it. I've really grown to love this era of Doctor Who because They hadn't nailed the show down. There was no rules or restrictions on what it could be. And people would do things, even if it did appear perhaps wildly inappropriate for the viewing audience, perhaps.
Yeah.
I know this got the lowest audience appreciation figures ever for any Doctor Who story. So, you know, that's probably why it's got its reputation. And it is so odd, but I just love that fact that at that point, Doctor Who could be anything, you know, and it was willing to try new things and experiment. And it's quite glorious, really.
So I think the third episode dropped down to an AI of about 30%. But from what I've seen, round about this era of Hartnell, most of them were averaging at about 50% anyway. So it wasn't like a sudden plunge from up in the 80s where we often see it now.
No, also, can I just say the audience, the AI, the, what's that, the appreciation index or something? That's what they have now, isn't it? Is naturally, because of the way it's done, tends to score higher. The audience appreciation figures were compiled differently to the way AI is done, and they trend lower naturally, the audience appreciation figures.
Oh, I see. They're not the same as AI.
No, so like the fact that...
Right, that makes lots of sense.
You know, Peter Capaldi's era, just picking one at random, I think he used to get stuff that was like... you know, if it went down to the late 80s in the AI, people go, oh, the show's doomed. And it's very different to the audience appreciation figures, I believe.
Initial thoughts, Hayden?
So I must have seen this, I think, when the DVD came out. And that was in the box sets called, was it Earth Stories? Where they lumped the gunfighters in with The Awakening. Yeah. For some strange reason. So I only saw it about...
Oh, Earth Story. It was just The Awakening.
That's it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, they couldn't really call it the bottom of the barrel, which is essentially what it was.
Bottom of the gun barrel, yeah.
Oh!
I watched this at a point where I was writing for Celestial Toy Room, and I think I was doing a run-through of the Hartnell era, a complete run-through, so obviously whatever I could find at that point, and as complete as could be. And I remember watching it and thinking, well, this is different, but this is at a time in the show's history where there is no established history yet with the programme. It's still very new. This is only the third year, you know, and this is a programme which has tried to do a comedy Dalek story in The Chase. This is also a series which has done something as terrible as, you know, the massacre of St. Bartholomew's Eve, as in the actual massacre itself, not the story, I must add there. It's had two companions die in a story just a few months before this. So it's not even a show that's finding its feet. It's a show that has arguably more freedom to do whatever the damn hell it wants to do than it ever has at any other point in its history. And that's what kind of makes the Hartnell era so significant, I think. And I agree with Mark, actually. I mean, it's odd and it's strange, but it is enjoyable, you know. And I think the enjoyment I get from it is the enjoyment that some of the actors like William Hartnell are clearly getting, because it seems to me like he's had a bit of a shot in the arm for this story. He's clearly in his element. Really enjoying himself, you know, they're playing around with them with Doc Holliday and Wyatt Earp, and he's clearly having a ball. Peter Purvis less so. He seems to play, I thought, the damsel in distress a little more here, and I did wonder whether, I don't think I've seen it anywhere really, but I did wonder whether Peter Purvis ever brings this one up as something that he hates as much as Galaxy 4, because he obviously doesn't like Galaxy 4 because he felt like most of his lines were those that were barbarous before he joined. He's not very proactive. He seems to be dressed like Marty McFly in Back to the Future Part 3 as well, I thought. And it's interesting because this is clearly something which changes over time, but there was obviously a period in the 50s and the 60s where the little boys growing up wanted to be cowboys. I mean, I suppose you had, you know, you had stuff like Bonanza and Maverick on TV. You know, the Milky Bar Kid was in his element during the ad breaks. And there was more of a sort of a heroism, I'd say, about the Wild West, which is kind of lost on my generation. Because like I said, I mean, really all we've got to go on is Back to the Future Part 3 when it comes to sort of cowboy stories. So it feels in that sense more like it's from even more of a bygone era. But watching it, I mean, you can't help but, yes, the song gets very tedious. It's quite charming at the start of the story. But by the very end, you're just wanting to sort of rip your own eardrums out and swallow them and listen to your digestive system slowly working on them instead of listening to The Last Chance Saloon once more. I think they could have used that a bit more sparingly, I think. I think Jackie Lane's quite good at this, actually. She seems to be having some fun. And, yes, of course, Anthony Jacobs is really good as Doc Holliday. Matthew Jacobs, writer of the TV movie, is his father here.
Mm.
And, of course, we've got the two Thunderbirds here as well, in Shane Remmer and David Graham. Or Kerensky, as he's more commonly known to Doctor Who fans. The voice that David Graham uses for Charlie is very close to the voice he uses for...
Mm.
Oh, I've forgotten the Doctor's name in... Fireball XL5. That kind of voice where he kind of talks like that is very... Oh, I've forgotten the name of the character in Fireball XL5 now. But yeah, he's very close to that.
Professor Matthew Matic.
That's it. Professor Matic.
That's one of the greatest theme tunes ever, that is.
What, you mean the I wish I was a spaceman,
the fastest man alive. I'd fly you round the universe. In Fireball XL5,
way out in space together,
conquerors of the stars. My heart will be a fireball, a fireball. That's perhaps we'll replace that with Sean Pertwee doing it.
No, it's just fun, isn't it? I mean, I think if it's taken in the context of it being a romp, which it so clearly is, there's a bit more of a spark. Sometimes with the Doctor's a good barometer, I think, as to what kind of adventure you're going to have. If the Doctor's sort of hamming it up a little bit, or being a bit clumsier, or being, you know, showing a bit more humour, then, especially when it's the Heart Doctor, you think you're kind of, it disarms you a bit, and it makes you think, oh, okay, well, yeah, so this is going to be a bit more of a fun ride. He's not going to be so, you know, grumpy and dour, or, you know, angry, where, you know, the stakes are going to be high. They're not going to be high in something like this. So yeah, so I quite enjoyed it. I really like the fight at the end, actually, on film.
Mm.
Oh, the gunfight.
Yeah, I thought that was actually quite well done. You can tell it was on film. The it was recorded in Ealing. Ealing, wasn't it? So,
well, you can tell as well because how the camera travelling up and down.
Yeah,
going from ground level and moving up.
Yeah, what you say about that, Mark? Is you know, obviously one of the most iconic images of any Western is seeing, you know, a man in the distance between someone else's legs, and you see the spurs of their boots. Have we been watching the same thing here?
That wasn't a Western. he may have been wearing a cowboy hat.
That does remind me of the exchange between Ringo and Billy. Where Ringo says,
I'll take him from behind while you face him. Never figured you for a back shooter, Ringo.
There's clearly some homoerotic subtext here.
I have to say, the what I was trying to say without my smutty co-presenters butting in there was that it's...
Excuse me, presenter?
It's a fairly iconic image, and there's quite a lot of low camera angles that you see.
Iconic framing.
Yes, that's it. Sorry, framing. Yeah, which that did remind me of, you know, stuff like The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, and for a few dollars more and a fistful of dollars. So it's yeah, it was good. I wouldn't go crazy with it, but I'd say it was enjoyable.
We've had two jabs and a booster, but we're still not immune. So we'll all be wearing face masks in the Last Chance Saloon. I thought it was interesting watching the Gunfight at the OK Corral movie that it starts off when they're, you've got the opening titles. You've got Frankie Lane doing a song, essentially saying, not entirely dissimilar from the, it's a sort of ballad thing anyway. And then at two points during the action, about 25 minutes in and about 60 minutes in, when there is a bit of, you know, riding through the plains and doing nothing else, he comes back and sings something along the lines of, oh, so Ike and the Clantons are now going to do this, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was very, very like, it's clearly where they've got the idea for the Ballad of the Last Chance Saloon from. It's just that they get it right by only doing it twice during the, and not over and over.
So cold, so still, why Earth, they say, saved Doc Holliday from old Boot Hill. So still, Wyatt roamed the West, and though he fought the best by nature, he preferred it nice and peaceful, sort of slow and sort of easy go. But he was quick on the draw, and Wyatt's work was long, was long, was long.
I mean, I think there are a few bits where, for instance, when the barman Charlie gets shot, and when who else gets shot?
Warren.
Warren gets shot in the jail. It could be quite a dramatic turn, were it not for the fact that they immediately go into a ballad verse about it, which rather takes away the impact of it, really. I can't say I was fascinated.
I was going to say about the song, actually, it didn't bother me anywhere near as much as I thought it would. It just kind of felt all a piece. So it was quite, not a problem for me.
I found the stuff with the Doctor interesting, where he's, because he's not got a big intergalactic mystery to solve. I mean, really, the only real thing he's got to do is to dream up a way of making sure that Stephen and Dodo don't get caught in all the crossfire, isn't it? He's not got a particular puzzle to solve. And so he's very much left to... He does look like he's having a good time, doesn't he? He's messing around with his jaw, with his toothache. Some nice little lines, like, they come out of the TARDIS. Stephen looks around down the street of this... Wild West Town said, oh.
It must be in the past, sometime.
Yes, a very observant, dear boy, but where?
How would I?
I thought William Hartnell was absolutely brilliant in this. I think his timing and his delivery of Donald Cotton's lines are everything. Mm. They're just great. And he's given such lovely, like you say, he's got that, he's doing a lot of physical stuff with his face. And some of the lines are lovely as well, like that.
I have no intention of trying anything. Only people keep giving me guns, and I do wish they wouldn't. I wonder, would you mind looking after it for me?
You know, and that bit where he says, I can't remember, they're talking about spitting. It's like a disgusting habit.
If you get between me and him, boy, don't go looking to me to hold my fire.
I'd blast you down as soon as spit at you.
Thanks. Disgusting habit.
And stuff like talking about Tom Mix and the whole Dodo DuPont and Stephen Regret thing. But the usual thing happened that's always the sign for me that I'm not particularly fascinated by it is that I had to watch an extra 20 minutes because I nodded off over the end of episode 2 and the beginning of episode 3. I think I must have originally seen this in the early 90s in my UK gold days. So I would have had it on a VHS, but it would have been something I'd recorded off the Omnibus broadcast edition of this on a Sunday morning. So that's where I'd have been familiar with it. I can't have watched it many times. But I think the really bad thing is where they have the stuff between the Clantons, usually sitting around in that bar, with the possible exception of Shane Rimmer. I think I'm thinking, God, he starts going on bloody accents again.
No, but they are really bad, aren't they? They're really bad accents.
But Ike is dreadfully the worst. It's not just that they keep slipping out of an American accent back to a British one. Mm. It's that they keep slipping back into an RP accent.
Yes.
Who is this, sorry?
Ike is the main one. But not just mid-sentence, but mid-word.
Mm,
yeah. The vowels seem to be those, particularly the O's. Instead of saying, oh, I'm going to film you full of holes. God, we could be right back in the Wild West, couldn't we? They're saying they're going to film you full of holes.
Brother Billy ain't scared.
Nobody said you was scared, boy.
Nobody.
Even Peter Purvis does it, doesn't he?
Yeah, but that's within character, though, isn't it?
Yeah, his role is to put on an Australian American accent, isn't it?
Okay, yeah, that's
okay. He's playing someone who's putting on an accent. I mean, Shane, of course, being Canadian, and because we struggle to really tell the difference between Canadian and American accents, I think he's got the easier time. In fact, I had to use subtitles for a lot of their stuff because it's so inaudible, and it is really bad. And I've read someone saying in my search for this, oh, yeah, well, you see wobbly sets, don't you? And you excuse those. So why are you so, you know, fussed about people having dodgy accents? Well, the whole point of Doctor Who is you could excuse the wobbly sets because the acting was such a high standard. So you can't say, oh, well, excuse the acting as well.
I mean, sets, that's more of a limitation of budget and time.
Yeah.
When it comes to the actors, yeah, that's performance. So that's completely different. That's a very different thing to look at. But to be honest, there were moments in this when I forgot that Shane Rimmer himself was Canadian. There were some moments when I thought maybe it was even rubbing off on him. But it does make me wonder sometimes when you've got actors who are speaking their native tongue or their native accent in something, and they're one of the only ones, and everyone else around them's doing a cod impression of a cowboy. Whether they go home at night and it's like, oh, how was your day, dear? And he goes, I've never been so embarrassed in my entire life. These people claim to be professionals, and I don't know.
We were just talking while you were just briefly. Why did you go to Hayden? You just supposed to check on William?
I was having a Wicker Man moment.
Oh, right. Oh, Jesus Christ, no!
Dana just popped up to the nursery on the fourth floor of the museum, ladies and gentlemen. Mark and I were just discussing when the doctor says...
Allow me, sir, to introduce Miss Dodo DuPont, Wizard of the Ivory Keys, and Stephen Regret Tenor, and lastly, sir, your humble servant, Dr. Caligari.
Doctor who?
Yes, you're quite right.
Is that the first instance in Doctor Who of the Doctor Who joke?
I think it must be. I'm just trying to think. Yeah, I think it is.
Probably. I couldn't believe that he called himself Dr. Caligari, because that's the... I don't know if you... I used to watch quite a lot of German expressionist films with my daughter Polly, basically old black and white, often silent films from the early 1920s, stuff like Nosferatu and one being the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. So it was quite a surprise for me to hear Dr. Caligari get name-checked.
What's it about?
It's a bit confusing. Essentially, the main plot appears to be that there's a doctor called Caligari who keeps a bloke in a cabinet and he lets him out at night to commit crimes. But the bloke in the cabinet is like hypnotized and he's sleepwalking when he's doing these crimes. But it's not quite as cut and dry as that, but that's basic thing. So Dr. Caligari is considered to be very much a manipulative evil man.
Right, I see.
Certainly for most of the film.
I found most of the best sort of humour, strangely, for Doctor Who is, there's quite a lot of slapstick in this, wasn't there? Mainly from Stephen, actually. You know, when they they walk into the bar and they do bing, they ring the bell on the bar for attention, and they just, he sort of leans back, really like a really cool cowboy against the bar. The barman turns up and he flinches. And he flinches again in the middle of the song. Great timing, actually.
Also, computer, could you show us the moment that the Doctor introduces Stephen as Stephen Regret? Honestly, look at Peter Purvis's face. It's great. It made me absolutely howl with laughter.
It looks like, what was the woman called who used to run Blue Peter?
Oh, Biddy Baxter.
It was like Biddy Baxter's just asked him to do a night shift, didn't it? But having said all that, I think the problem with the accents is mostly restricted to those four, or maybe those three, whereas people like Johnny Ringo, Doc Holliday and Wyatt Earp, they're not. Put it this way, I didn't notice. It doesn't stand out as being particularly bad or something. Now, an American listening to that might have, well, an American from the 1880s might have listen to that and I thought, oh God, that's not a very good approximation of one of our accents. But it was certainly suitable for a BBC audience. Was she called Kate?
Yes.
It wasn't brilliant, but at least it wasn't entirely dreadful. She was one of the best characters in the film. Played her... someone called Jo Van Fleet, who I'm assuming I've not heard of before. She has an extraordinary sort of relationship with Kirk Douglas as Doc Holliday, where she says something insulting to him. He throws a flick knife at her, which sticks in the wall behind her dressing table. Having been briefly shocked, she drags it out of the wall and just flings herself on it to stab him. And not in an argument, they're lovers. It's just a lover's tiff. I thought it was quite amusing. Did you spot the Billy Fluff?
Oh, yes.
I know.
Where? The OK... Well, that sounds like...
The Wild West!
It can't be, can it?
Well, why not? If that chance I've got of finding a dentist in the Middle West... Oh, please, bust you.
Mr. Cotton could have given us Rio Bravo or High Noon. Instead of which, he landed us with The Last Chance Saloon. This is probably a condemnation of Tristram Cary. How long this f***ing ballad is going on throughout this thing? The jingle isn't memorable at all.
Yeah, Tristram Cary, he didn't write the words.
No, I'm talking about the jingle, the music itself.
No, I know what you mean. Well, it was only supposed to be for us a small section of it, wasn't it? I think it ended up getting expanded. And apparently it's supposed to be Dodo singing the song, but Jackie Lane was such a bad singer that they got Peter Purvis to sing instead.
Didn't Rex Tucker want to get his daughter to sing the ballad? But I think they decided that her voice wasn't strong enough. And so she did end up in a singing career. If anyone from who used to watch Rainbow remembers Jane from Rod, Jane and Freddie.
Yeah.
That was Rex Tucker's daughter.
No! No, wow. Oh, sorry, if it sounds as though I've been quiet, I've been sitting here and just in my head just going, so as Mark strikes 100 and Doc lost his cool, Hayden was sitting mulling what rhymes with saloon.
Oh, he's got the tune, the back. Da, 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 da. Oh, that's good, yes. We won't give up our beer money to Tim Weatherspoon. After Brexit, we're all drinking in the Last Chance Saloon.
Brilliant, well done.
I think it's interesting that at this period, if you think about it, Series 3, you've got Galaxy 4, which you've got three episodes missing from, haven't you? You've got Mission to the Unknown and the Mythmakers, which are all missing. Dalek Master Plan, we know that 1, 2, 3, 4, 5...
But there's 9 episodes missing.
Yeah, missing. Massacre of St. Bartholomew's Eve is all missing.
Yeah.
Celestial Tournament has got 3 episodes missing. Then we've got this, which is complete. Then the Savages is all missing. The Smugglers is all missing. And then that's the 10th Planet is the final. So really, in a run of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 consecutive stories, there's only 2 complete.
There's 3, isn't there?
What's the other one?
You got the War Machines at the end
of
the season.
Oh, sorry, yes, I've only got a list of what's actually missing. So, you know, we can't really tell, can we, whether... we hear great things about Massacre, don't we, and Master Plan. But maybe... I've never actually gone through watching Savages or Smugglers in any format. So,
No, me neither. Oh, no, I have, but anyway.
Because I was saying that these audience appreciation scores are quite low all over at this sort of time. Mm. Whether it's not unusual that this is... Why they'd keep the Gunfighters when it had such a dodgy reputation is beyond me.
Well, they weren't kept on reputation, were they? Otherwise,
no,
most of what was kept would be the stuff that's missing. That would have been the way it was. It's sad because it's not so much the second half of season 3, because like you said, okay, yeah, 3 episodes of Celestial Toymaker and the Savages are missing. So that's 7 episodes out of the final 5 stories, I think. It's that first half, isn't it? Where there's only 4 surviving episodes out of how many episodes? Yes. 25 or something?
Something like
which
that.
Is just utterly crazy. Mm. Utterly crazy. But tonally, season 3 is all over the place. And it is mainly because there's so much going on behind the scenes. We start off the season with Verity Lambert in place, then John Wiles takes over, then it's Innes Lloyd at the end of the season, and in that time you've had Donald Tosh, you've had... There's so much going on here at the time where Hartnell's health is failing too. Really, you could say, for the vast majority of it, there's only really one person who seems to be holding the show up, and that is Peter Purvis.
Yes, I think so, yeah.
But I don't see that so much in this story. I do see him quite maligned. This is more of a showpiece for Hartnell, I'd say, than it is anything else. Whereas the stuff that's missing, like the massacre, like swathes of Master Plan, and obviously Mythmakers, where Purvis is given more of a time, got more of a chance to shine. And of course, the Savages, which is a big story for him also, is that's the stuff that's gone. So it is difficult, yeah. But the Gunfighters, it's probably the story that was needed after Master Plan. Because I can imagine sitting down as a child watching this in the 60s and thinking, blimey, you've just had, you know, the Time Destructor's just gone off. It's killed Sarah Kingdom. The Doctor's aged before he arrives. The stills and the production stills and also the archive audio from that final episode of the Daleks' Master Plan sounds horrifying.
Mm.
And then you go straight from that to the massacre of St. Bartholomew's Eve. It must have been... I mean, no wonder the ratings, the actual viewership went down a bit after this. After Master Plan, didn't it? Because it could have done with either this or the Celestial Toymaker taking place afterwards. It's the kind of thing now that you'd see someone like Russell T. Davis sitting down, planning his season out, going, right, well, I've got something like... Aliens of London and World War II, followed by Dalek. Do you know what I mean? So then you've got a bit more of a sort of balance going on there.
Yeah, well, Stephen Moffat moving Night Terrors.
Yes, yeah, from the beginning of the series, because the beginning of the series is too dark. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. So, but obviously they were writing this stuff and making this stuff a week or two in front of them putting it out at this point, weren't they? So,
yeah.
It's very hand to mouth, but it's a fun romp. You know, it's never going to be. I always think it's unfairly maligned because there is stuff that tries to take itself too seriously in Doctor Who and fails completely.
Yes.
That deserves to be below this. when it comes to the rankings and what have you, DWM do. Yeah, the Gunfighters is always sort of in the top, well, is it bottom 30?
Yeah, it is. And I, to be honest, after watching this, I was thinking that it was, for me, personally, it was a candidate for, I mean, I do think there are five better stories, but it was, but I was thinking, I wonder if I'd put this in my top five Hartnells. I enjoyed it that much.
Really? Oh, right.
No, yeah, just because it's just really enjoyable, really funny. Again, I think I've said this before recently, that watching like an old story like this and seeing, I think I mentioned it when we were talking about the Evil of the Daleks and that remaining episode that we had compared to the animated version. And you miss a lot of Patrick Troughton's physicality and stuff when he's doing it. And that physical interplay between him and Fraser Hines. And you miss that in the animation because it's just the two, you know, there's that whole business with the vase and the stuff with the door of the shop. And I think with this as well, you see that Hartnell's so good with his physical comedy. You see that in this and in The Romans. And it breaks my heart because one of my favourite stories that is wiped is The Mythmakers. And I think I love the cobbled together from very little, the recon, just because the script was so good and was so funny. And I can't help thinking how good that would be if we could. I just would love to see Hartnell actually on screen doing that properly. Just makes me really sad, to be honest. So the reason I think this has moved up into like to be a possible top five is purely because I can see it, so I can see how good Hartnell is in it, and I can see his like his physical performance, and it just breaks my heart that these stories are missing.
Yeah. Funny you should bring up Patrick Troughton, because did you know that he was offered the role of Johnny Ringo?
Yes,
for this story.
Apparently.
Yeah.
Weren't they going to try to get Donald Sutherland for a white up?
Yes, they did. Yeah, it's crazy. Another little, I don't think this is a well-known fact, but when I was doing the research for this story, I came across the production assistant who worked on this was Tristan DeVere Cole. And he also directed Doctor Who, and he only directed one story, and that was The Wheel in Space, which I found interesting, even if no one else did. But anyway.
That's Elwisty.
I'm glad I found people of a like mind.
I saw a stick today and it moved.
Oh, was it stick, was it? Oh. Oh, kudos to the production team for getting a live horse in Television Centre again.
Yeah. That was a pretty impressive start, wasn't it?
Yeah, they had a flipping elephant in the Ark a few weeks earlier.
Yeah.
I think they should have got the elephant back and dressed him up as a horse.
Well, it would have been about as convincing as Billy Clanton's accent.
Oh, don't. I don't really have any...
Nor do I, really.
Well, I don't have anything else to say.
Give me a number out of 10. 10 being woohoo, 1 being...
So, marks out of 10? I would give it a 6.5.
Marco, what would you give it?
Oh, I see. I would... do you know what? I'm just going to score it on pleasure it gave and the fact that I just really, really enjoyed William Hartnell's performance in this. And like I say, he's just an absolute boss. So I'm going to give this an 8.5.
Oh, wow.
It's got its faults. I just really, really enjoyed it.
Hayden?
Oh, yeah, I haven't gone yet, have I? Sorry, no, that's them. It's hard, isn't it? I'm going to give it a 5.
Oh, really?
But that doesn't mean I don't like it. It just means that it's... it just means... meany. It just means that it's...
It means that it is awful, but you do like it.
Yeah.
In the words of Dick Emery.
What does Fraud Prefect say to Zaphod Beeblebrox? I just want you to know that whatever happens I respect you. Just not very much, that's all.
Yeah, it's enjoyable. It's middle of the road, so it's a 5. It's not an outstanding story, so I would give it a 5. But I did not like it.
I think you're a mean, miserly person. I didn't.
Am I the?
Oh no! I'm only joking when I'm saying that. You know, that's absolutely fine. You give it 5. Thing is, if something gives me great pleasure, I become overly generous towards it. Ask my exes.
This coming down the corridor in a Tom Mix outfit. Well, it's Uncle Terence. Uncle Terence, those spurs are playing havoc with our parquet flooring.
Yes, and they're not doing very well at the moment when it comes to playing Everton as well, do they? So fill up your glasses and join in the song. The law's right behind you and it won't take long. So come, you coyotes, and howl at the moon till there's blood upon the sawdust in the last chance saloon. It's your last chance of earning your gunfighter's fee. The pay is in dollars, but the bullets are free. It's the last chance of cussing at the gunfighter's doom. It's your last chance of nothing at the last chance saloon.
Well, I think you look smashing, Uncle Terence. Here comes Uncle Terence. He'll have you all a-quiver when he says, don't dump bodies into the river.
When Mark does Terence, he sounds like
David Bellamy.
David Bellamy, that's it, yes.
Uncle Terence, you'll see all these dead bodies around. I'm afraid there's just been a shootout. Have you got any advice for us?
Yes, don't play that bloody song again. We'll be playing Royalties next, Royalties.
Uncle Terence. We have the Clantons in Sector 27.
It's a trap in the last chance saloon.
Goodbye, everyone.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye, everybody. Bye-bye.
You have been listening to the Diddly Dumb Podcast. Find us on our blog at diddlydumbpodcast.wordpress.com, on iTunes, Facebook, Audioboo, and Stitcher.com at diddlydumb, on Twitter at diddly_dumb, or email us at diddlydumbpodcast@yahoo.co.uk.
Diddly Dumb. Meaty, not runny. Top breeders recommend it because it's solid nourishment for the ears.